Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm your host, Rob Hunt, coming to you from beautiful, sunny Southern California, also known as the Promised Land.
They're working on the T-Bone State, call a contact over to the Golden State. When the pilot told us in 13 minutes he'd be headed in the channel again. Swing low, switch high, and come down easy, touch it to the terminal zone. Cut your engines and cool your wings and let me make it to the telephone. Los Angeles, human all folk, Virginia Tide and water for 10-09. Till the folks back close to the promised land, calling the poor boys on the line.
So, lots to go over today. Unfortunately, my co-host Larry Mishkin has decided that Sedona, Arizona and the Grand Canyon are a greater pull for him than doing the show today. But we miss Larry, and hopefully he's having a terrific vacation with his family. I do have the good fortune of being joined today by our producer, Dan Humiston. So Dan will be jumping in here to discuss a little bit of Grateful Dead and certainly some cannabis topics, of which he knows a great deal about. So how are you doing today, Dan?
I'm great. I miss Larry. We just got a phone call from him from the Grand Canyon, said for some reason he doesn't have any internet down there, so I think it's a lame excuse, but we're thinking of you, Larry.
I think that if I were sitting in Sedona right now and I've been in cold Chicago all winter, I probably wouldn't be doing the show today either. So, you know, Larry, have a great time. Enjoy the desert. Have fun out there. So it's you and me today winging it instead. No fearless leader in Larry Mishkin. But I think we have a lot of stuff that we can cover today. First of all, we're looking at June 12th from 1980, which is Portland, Oregon. A really, really fun show as part of the Grateful Dead's kind of Northwestern run. It's right around the time of their 15th anniversary. So they did the Folsom Field shows in Boulder and then came out and did a little bit of Northwest, the Portland, Oregon shows and the Seattle, Washington. So this one's a lot of fun. I'll get into some of the reasons why this one's a special show a little bit later. Lots to cover in the cannabis world as well. So maybe we'll dive right in there because there's a lot of exciting stuff. And I'll start off with one that, you know, you and I touched a little bit on earlier, Dan, which is some interesting news coming out of Delaware, something that we really haven't seen, you know, in the trajectory of legalization of cannabis at all. And that's that, you know, we're watching a democratically elected or a Democrat governor veto a bill that the House put forward for cannabis legalization. But more importantly, after the veto, didn't get the override with a very, you know, strong left side of the aisle state house that could have easily overridden the veto and didn't. And it's the first time we've seen this happen. What are your thoughts on it?
I haven't read the bill. And so that, but, you know, off the top of my head, I'm just like, this doesn't make any sense because all the polls point to this is an accepted position. And so I can't imagine, especially a Democratic or Democrat would think, well, this is going to help my position or help my future in the office. I can't imagine that that's his thinking. So unless there's something in this bill that just doesn't make any sense or is unfair, I can't understand why he would do this. I mean, I just can't fathom that somebody as much as they know right now would be against this for outdated beliefs. But
yeah, you know, and the interesting thing is, I don't think it is as a result of being a poor bill. I mean, the bill sailed through committee and then sailed through the House initially, you know, getting 26 votes. And then when the veto happened, it came back and they had the chance to override it and only got 20 votes. And so it wasn't a question of the House, you know, disliking the bill. But what I will say is that, you know, Governor John Carney of Delaware has been very vocal about his opposition to cannabis legalization in general. Certainly is no friend of the cannabis plant. So it wasn't a question of this coming out of left field that, you know, we thought that he'd be supportive. I mean, he certainly made it clear previously that if a bill came to his desk, he wasn't, you know, inclined to support it. So that part of it, you know, we're expecting the veto. You know, the veto didn't bother me. But then when it goes back, you know, to the House to say, okay, well, what do you guys want to do here? It was a 20-20 vote with one member abstaining. Had it been a 26th vote, then it would have had the votes it needed to get across the line. So that's where it's a little bit odd to me. And again, we're not talking about, you know, in a pretty heavy red state. We're talking, as you know, as you mentioned earlier, this is, you know, Joe Biden land. This is, you know, in between Jersey and Delaware, or excuse me, Jersey and Maryland, two bastions of progressive cannabis policy. So to see it happen in Delaware, I mean, look, okay, maybe you've got a little bit of, like, you know, sort of the old DuPont regime that's been running that state for a long time, and you know, a little bit of like, you know, more conservative Dems than you do in most states, you know, coming out of Wilmington. But you know, this isn't what you expected, especially in, you know, kind of the trajectory when everything else, like the entire country, is moving more progressive on cannabis policy. To see this state in particular slow down.
Yeah, I agree. It feels like we're missing something. It really does. Unless, like you said, this is the hill he wants to die on. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of. If he is saying, I'm drawing a line in the sand and I'm not budging on this, I don't understand it. And all the data doesn't support his position. And it just seems like he's really stuck in the past, but
yeah, which, you know, we do see in other places. And that kind of is a good segue to, you know, one of the next things I wanted to cover today, which is, I don't know if you read Alicia Finley's Wall Street Journal opinion that came out the other day, trying to make this connection between violent crime and cannabis, which has now been pushed by, you know, Laura Ingraham's been on her show and talking about it as well, and trying to say, like, okay, with these, you know, mass shootings that are happening and some of the other violent crime that we're seeing in inner cities and in other places, that, you know, how come people aren't taking a greater look at the correlation between the uptick in cannabis use and psychosis and violent crime that's happening, with literally zero to back up these claims. And this is again, let me point out, this is not the Wall Street Journal, you know, coming out with the editorial side doing this. This is an opinion in the Wall Street Journal. But the fact that the Wall Street Journal, you know, decided to publish this one, and where she was, you know, sort of going to was data that Alex Berenson was providing. And I don't know if you're familiar with Alex Berenson, but this is a guy that fell absolutely flat on his face with data about, you know, what was going to happen with vaccinations. So he was a former, you know, New York Times journalist. But Berenson's been, you know, previously relatively sympathetic to the cannabis industry. Certainly has a big following, but, you know, to put this out there and then, you know, use it as fodder for all sorts of right-wing pundits right now to say, you know, look at this devil weed and all the violence that it's creating. You know, that I expected out of some certain people, but I was very surprised to see that the Wall Street Journal was brazen enough to put that, you know, in its print edition.
Yeah. My brother's a police officer, and we've had this discussion before. He says, Dan, we never, ever have any problems with people who are smoking cannabis. All of our problems are with alcohol. People that smoke cannabis are not aggressive.
But I think that's a different question, though, isn't it? I mean, that's the question of, like, you know, are people inclined to get in, you know, fights, like, you know, the way bar fights happen? I think this is more a question of, you know, psychosis that's caused by, like, prolonged use over time, of whether or not that affects your brain and affects your capacity to make rational decisions. This isn't, you know, like, hey, I got drunk one night and did something stupid. This is, you know, I used for a long time, and as a result, you know, it's changed my ability to, my cognitive ability to deal with life. So, but again, you know, the only time you've ever seen that kind of propaganda is usually coming out of groups that stand to make a profit from taking that position, which is normally, you know, the incarceration lobby, or it's the people that make money on rehabilitation. So it's rare to see it, you know, like, look, we've got how many millions of users right now in how many states that are legal, that are openly purchasing, where, you know, $40 billion a year industry. And this is just, you know, a recent legal industry. Prior to that, we've got 50 years of anecdotal evidence of a massive amount of users of cannabis that psychosis and violent tendencies over prolonged use were to manifest themselves in any meaningful way. That would have already been demonstrated. I mean, there's no question that, you know, like, if that was the case, we wouldn't be seeing the legalization movement that we're seeing today, because people say, wait a second, this has been asked and answered, and there's a proclivity to violence and a proclivity to other sorts of mental illness that we've already identified even prior to legalization. So that's why I find it just really, really interesting that, you know, this reefer madness is now, like, coming back, like, really now, like, after all we've achieved, after all, you know, as far as we've gotten, you know, I can't think of a single time. Take, you know, your experience with law enforcement and your family aside, this is a much bigger question as to, you know, long-term detrimental effect.
Well, you make a good point, and that we don't have the data to support this. They don't have the data to support this, which doesn't always stop somebody from putting something out there. maybe just as clickbait, maybe just to be a contrarian, maybe just to get attention to their site. It's hard to tell what motivated somebody to do something like this, but it just seems like it's a non-starter.
Yeah, look, you're absolutely right. I mean, Kevin Sabet's been doing this for years, right? You know, he's been out there with smart approaches to marijuana and trying to sell people on the fact that, oh, no, it's not that I'm against cannabis. It's just that we really need to think about how we're going to do these integrations. And, you know, like we have to consider 100 things you're not considering right now. Ultimately, you know, if you listen to his message, it's I'm very anti-cannabis. I'm just trying to pretend that I'm not. But what's it for? It's because he's making a great deal of money on you know, the lobby that he's developed, and a great deal of money on selling materials and being interviewed and being a speaker at events. So, you know, if there's a way to be a pundit of some sort where, you know, you're receiving monetary gain for doing it, there's a lot of people that are willing to say almost anything you want them to say or anything they think is going to sell books or sell, you know, sell airtime.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. But hopefully this one doesn't gain any traction and it's just, we look back on this as just say one, it was one failed attempt to slow down the movement.
Yeah, exactly. And to all you out there in the audience, know that, you know, this is certainly not anything that I ever say to try to gain audience, because if I have, it certainly hasn't been working. Thank you to a couple thousand of you out there that are listening to us consistently. But you know, no one's paying me to put forward my positions on how I feel about progressive cannabis policy.
Yeah.
So hey, you know, getting back to the music for a minute, you know, the show that I chose. Yeah, I know you're not a huge Grateful Dead fan. You can't nerd out the way Larry and I can on some of this stuff. But I don't know if you remember, but May 18th, 1980 was the day that Mount St. Helens initially erupted just outside of Portland, Oregon, with, you know, pretty cataclysmic effect. And most people remember that May 18th eruption. They don't realize there's multiple other eruptions that happened subsequently over the next couple of months. So it was, you know, eruption after eruption after eruption. There were three of them that were pretty massive, you know, not nearly as big as the first. But, you know, if you were living in the Northwest at that time, you were largely covered in ash for quite a few months there. And it was coming down like rain all over the Pacific Northwest. So, you know, an interesting time to be there. It was, you know, sort of for me, one of the catalysts as a young kid, I think I was 8 years old when it happened, of like thinking earthquakes and volcanoes were so cool, you know, with the 1989 earthquake in San Francisco being the other major catalyst that got me into like wanting to be a geoengineer in college until I realized there was math involved. As I always say, us attorneys are the smartest guys that aren't scientists or mathematicians. We're the ones that fall back on a fallback position of, you know, well, this is a hell of a lot easier than that. But St. Helens, you know, was a big deal. It was a really big deal then. And there's, you know, some legendary stories about, you know, the Grateful Dead's performance that day in Portland, because it coincided with a third eruption on June 12th, 1980. There was another, you know, massive eruption that happened, and the entire venue, you know, when people were leaving, their cars were coated in ash and the highways were coated in ash. And as people were trying to make it from the venue from Portland up to Seattle for the next shows, a lot of them had massive engine problems that were their cars were shutting down because the intake just wasn't working. So there's cars stranded all over the highway. And fortunately, the band made it. The band got to the next venue. But it made for, you know, kind of a legendary thing. There's very few times, I mean, like you talk about like sort of the random things that happen that coincide with the Grateful Dead performance, and whether it's, you know, like just weird stuff that you heard happening in Giza when they played in Egypt in 78, or, you know, Giant Stadium in 89, when they played, the music never stopped, and the line balls of lightning roll along and a lightning bolt hit the stadium at that moment. You know, there's definitely like sort of these magical moments where people look back and be like, whoa. But to have an eruption happen roughly at the same time as you're starting the second set with a Scarlet Fire and having a fire on the mountain where the mountain is literally on fire right up the street from you. And the eruption was enough that it was so cataclysmic that, you know, it caused an earthquake simultaneously and everyone felt this thing, is one of those times that, you know, people look back and be like, wow, there's some cosmic Grateful Dead stuff going on this night. So I figured it'd be a good one to feature, but let's listen to a little bit of the Cassidy, because the end of the first set was pretty damn pretty hot as well.
Flight of the seabirds, scattered like lost words, wheel to
storm and fly.
So that was the end of the Cassidy from that show. You know, one of the things about 1980 is it really doesn't get a tremendous amount of fanfare. You know, a lot of people talk about 77, obviously. 78 and 79 still had, you know, a lot of big shows. 79 was, you know, when Brent joined the band. 78 is when Keith, you know, was just leaving the band. But 1980, you know, it should be considered to be a much bigger year. And as I said, there's the 15th anniversary shows that people talk about from Folsom Field. And they played up in Anchorage, Alaska, which is another one that's, you know, pretty well loved show, but it just doesn't get the same attention from the fan base. And I've never really understood why. And when you listen to that cast, you think, wow, these guys are playing as well as they've ever played. So it's, for me, kind of strange that it's a largely forgotten year, but lots more to talk about on that show. But in the meantime, we've covered some bad cannabis news. Let's talk about some good things that are happening, because there's definitely some positive news out there. And one of them that you and I covered earlier, Dan, was what's happening in D.C. right now. You know, we got a great bill that passed yesterday that bans employers from firing workers for using cannabis.
Yeah, hopefully this is the first of many bills that pass to give employers some guidelines, some guidance, and some protection, because it's scary. I can see from an employer standpoint, we talked about this, particularly if I have contract, government contracts, federal government contracts that I don't want to put in jeopardy, you know, it puts me in a really tough spot. This gives you a little bit of some flexibility, some guidelines as to what you can and can't do, and protects you in case maybe are called onto the mat and said, hey, wait a minute, this employee, and we could cancel your government contract. And you can say, no, there's a bill. We're protected by this bill. So I really feel encouraged by this. And I just hope other states and other municipalities will follow suit. This is a really good sign.
It's a great sign, but it also, you know, raises all sorts of new questions. And the primary question is, can you have a policy in DC that is in direct opposition to the policy of a multi-state corporation? You know, the hypothetical I'd give here is that, let's say you're a company that transacts business in all 50 states, and you've got employees in, you know, sort of satellite offices in all 50 states. And if you have a policy that says, hey, we drug test all employees, and if our employees, you know, pass a drug test for cannabis, that our blanket policy across the business is that we terminate them. And by the way, our insurance policy requires that we terminate these employees. Now, is there an issue where they say, we're going to fire the employee, and the employee goes, well, wait a second, I'm in DC. You can't do that. I've got protections here. Now, the question is, you know, from a legal standpoint, who actually wins that battle? And something that, you know, I've been looking at as a question for, no kidding, over 10 years now. I think it's about 15 years since this first came up. And I'll give just a quick little bit of history on this, that in 2009, I want to say, I was in a continuing legal education class in Colorado that was conducted by an insurance company, and he was discussing like drug testing policies and was talking about the new legalization of cannabis in Colorado. And, you know, the fact that he is an advisor to quite a few companies, and said, look, you know, if someone tests positive for cannabis, I let the employer know that, you know, you've got to terminate them. And a lot of us in the class that, you know, it's like 50-50 cannabis supporters and non, and the cannabis supporters are like, well, wait a second, this is legal in Colorado. Like, you can't do that to an employee. If they're a medical cannabis patient, and this is before adult use, you know, if you're a medical cannabis patient, you can't terminate someone for that. And he came back and said, look, you know, we have blanket policies for a lot of these insurance programs. He said, you know, I tell the employer that, you know, very likely you might have to settle a wrongful termination suit. And then he brought up a hypothetical, and I think I've talked about this in the show before, of a woman that he recommended be terminated, who suffered from MS, who was wheelchair bound, and still recommended the termination of this employee. And, you know, knowing that the optics of it were terrible, like, here's a woman that really truly derived benefit from use of cannabis. But the idea behind his recommendation was, well, if she gets away with using a medical necessity excuse, then how many other people are going to be able to do the same? And it destroys the entire policy that the company set in place. So he said, better to settle with, you know, better to terminate her and then settle a wrongful termination suit with her in an arbitration agreement than it is to actually to allow it to go through, to say, okay, we're going to make an exception because now you've opened the door. And so long story on this is we got pretty far into it. And I said, I think that's absolutely ridiculous. And I don't think you can do that. So what happens that, what if that same employee tested positive for OxyContin? And this is before the whole opioid crisis had really kicked off. And he said, well, OxyContin is legal. And I said, sure, if you've got a prescription, but what if someone's, buying OxyContin on the street? He's like, oh, we couldn't know that because of HIPAA violations. We can't ask what they're, and I said, okay, well, you're right about that, but HIPAA should protect whether or not, a cannabis patient, if they test positive for cannabis, they should be able to say, I've got a recommendation for this, and you shouldn't have to be able to verify it any more than you should for OxyContin. He said, no, because of the federal illegality, we don't take that stance. And he said, second of all, no one's abusing OxyContin. And half the class just goes, oh, come on. You're not paying attention. What we're seeing coming out of DC right now from the standpoint of, how it's going to work, I think it's going to require quite a few other places to follow suit and say, hey, we believe in what DC has done. We've got to provide these same protections, because if not, and they're just an outlier, I don't know whether or not it's strong enough to provide the protections that they think they're providing from a legal standpoint.
Yeah, you make a lot of good points. I think it's really more of if you're just located in the district, then it works, that it'd work fine for you. But if you're a company, say like Lockheed Martin, what are they going to do? They're not going to just carve out. I don't know for sure, but it seems as though they probably would take the same stance that your professor took, and they're not going to carve out the district. They're going to just deal with those one-offs as they come up. But I think in a big picture, it's identifying this issue and acknowledging that there's a concern and that it needs to be addressed. And so hopefully this is the first step in a multi-step process that starts to move other states, other municipalities towards the same position. And I don't know that it's going to matter until the whole country's there, but, and like you said, if your insurance policy, I don't want to lose my insurance policy. I don't want to jeopardize that. So there's a lot more variables in this than meets the eye.
Yeah, for sure. And look, the single thing I'd say to most employers is stop complaining about not being able to find employees if you drug test. If you're testing for cannabis in today's day and age, and you don't have heavy machinery, or you don't have, specialized work that requires someone to, be 100% on it at the moment. Look, I'm not advocating that anyone use cannabis before they go to any job, but cannabis stays in your system much longer. It's fat soluble. It's almost impossible to detect when you're using it. And you can do an anagram test, but you're not going to test for whether or not there's inebriation at the time of the test, or whether or not it was from, the day before, or 4 days before, or a week before. So for that reason, there's a lot of companies that are having a lot of trouble finding qualified applicants because of their drug testing policy, especially around cannabis. So, if you're a company that, you're not asking people to perform very technical things that require absolute sobriety, if you're just a rank and file, employer, stop testing for weed. It's relatively simple. If you want good applicants, and if you don't, then don't be surprised when your applicant pool is one third of what it would be otherwise, because there's a lot of people in the age 21 to 30 age group that have no intention of ever working for a company that tests them for cannabis. Why would they do it? And I know that your daughter's in this industry of doing recruiting. I'm guessing that there isn't a person that's that she's recruiting that would be willing to work for a company that's going to drug test them for cannabis.
Especially if they're looking for a job in cannabis.
And do you remember 10 years ago, there was companies in the cannabis industry that were like, oh yeah, we're still, we're looking at getting insurance policies that have drug testing. And everyone's like, you can't deal with what hypocrisy? Of course you can't do that.
I know.
And so, there's a pretty vocal opposition to it back then, of saying if you're going to be a cannabis company, you can't drug test for cannabis. It's don't do it. But now that's a lot more widespread, and I think there's a lot of people that are realizing that they've got to make new decisions around what their policy is for drug testing in general.
Yeah, I just think it's a good. I think we're moving again. This road that we're on seems like, for people that are in the industry, seems like it's taking forever. It's like we're in a traffic jam and we're just slowly moving along. But if you look at it, if you take a step back and you see how far we've come, we're making progress, and this is one more arrow in the quiver. We're getting one step closer with this. That's a good sign. I'm not excited about the Delaware governor. I think that's a bad sign, but overall, I think that's going to be a, you know, a small setback. This is one step forward. What's going on in DC?
Yeah, and then look, I think we're seeing all sorts of little incremental steps all over the place. So it's if Delaware is the one outlier right now of kind of a step backwards, usually it's like 20 or 30 steps forward before you see a step backward like that. And I think we're going to see more and more states, or even within a state, become increasingly progressive, whether it's, you know, announcing the addition of new licenses, or whether it's expanding the program to new applicants, or whether it's, realizing greater tax production, based on cannabis. That's a lot of the news that we're seeing these days, just, how much money is coming in for cannabis taxes, and how much money is coming in just to the industry in general, and how many people they're employing. So the more mature the industry gets, the more accepted it gets, the better off we are, and the less we expect to hear from people like, Alicia Finley over at the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah. So. And if it's got to be, and if we have to have a state that's going to say no, might as well be one of the smallest states in our country.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And no disrespect to Delaware, but honestly, no one really cares what you guys do. We care what New York does. We care what California does. We care what Florida does. We care what Texas does. Those are states that move our needle politically. But even those states, we're seeing a lot of movement even internally with those states. I mean, New York, we're looking closer and closer to full blown legalization and actually selling into the adult use market. So I'm excited. I think this summer is going to be a watershed summer in general. And one other positive piece of news I think that we can touch on quickly is, we always kind of phrase this in partisan terms as far as who we expect to lead the charge. We certainly have seen some Republicans in the past, especially in the House, that have been very vocal as advocates, for cannabis reform. But it's rare that you see it in the Senate. You see like the libertarian side of the Senate, the Ted Cruzes, the Rand Pauls, the Marco Rubios, who have been supportive of cannabis policy, but not usually like overtly supportive of saying, hey, I'm really going to push an agenda. But we saw it this week. We saw Steve Daines out of Montana, the senator from Montana, actually put an ad out that said, let's get safe banking passed. And, again, Montana is not a state that moves the needle politically, but it is a very conservative state in general. It's got some pockets like, Whitefish and Missoula that are pretty, pretty progressive. But the entire eastern side of the state might as well be the Dakotas. And, for him to come out and push this policy of saying, safe needs to pass, I was really excited to see that.
Yeah. I mean, in my opinion is you don't even have to be pro-cannabis to support this bill, because this is just pro safety. Like, you don't want cash. You don't want a cash economy. It's dangerous for everybody. It's dangerous for customers. It's dangerous for employees. It's dangerous for people just walking by. So whether you're a pro cannabis or anti-cannabis, you should not be against this bill. And I think that's, I don't know why more people in Congress don't feel that way, because this is really a pro safety bill. Like, you just, cash is just creates an environment that's just not safe for anybody. And why do we want it? Why are we taking a step back? We're trying to get away from a cash economy. We're trying to get away from people carrying big wads of cash. It really baffles my mind sometimes. So when somebody, whether they're really far right leaning or really far left leaning, comes out against it, I just scratch my head.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, it's a simple adage that we've known for years. And I think to paraphrase one of the great bank robbers of all time, Willie Sutton, why do people rob banks? That's where the money is, So
where the money is.
The same thing is true of cannabis dispensaries. The second you force people to pay in cash is the second you're making them a soft target. And as a result, you're making everyone else in that facility or around that facility a soft target. So in an age right now where, gun safety or just safety in general and how to, harden different places, you don't have to harden a dispensary. You just have to make it safe so that the people who go into that dispensary don't have to worry. You don't necessarily need armed guards at a dispensary. The only reason you need one is if you're actually, enticing someone else to try to come in and rob you. And that's, that's muted completely by digital transactions. So I applaud Steve Daines.
I think, and the other thing that's always puzzled me, or I always felt was overplayed, was I just don't feel like criminals are going to be as motivated to go in and rob a dispensary just to rob their cannabis. I mean, that would be a hard thing to pull off. Like, they're only going there to get the cash, not the cannabis.
Of course.
Like,
I mean, it's one of the great misnomers, right? For a long time, it's like, oh, well, there's all these drugs in there. And they're going for the drugs. What, are you guys joking me? Like, how much weed are you going to steal? You're like, they've got a year's supply worth of vapes? Like, come on. I mean, maybe you could say, okay, they're doing it to, like, put it out and resell it. But again, that says to me, like, you know, there's got to be safe ways to do this. And a lot of the things that the industry itself have been pushing, which is, you know, hey, let's have a way to track and trace, you know, everything, barcode everything, or find other ways to you know, make sure that if someone actually has a product and they're trying to divert it, that you can identify the diverted product. But to your point, it's not about the weed. It's about the money. It's very, very simple. Guys don't go in there going like, give me all your weed.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And like, so your pool of criminals is so much smaller, because not only if I'm just going in there to rob your weed, now I got to sell it. Like, but if I can go in there and take your cash, like, that just opens it up to everybody. Like, every criminal could do that, but only a smaller portion of the criminals can take your weed and sell it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, this is dumb. It's just dumb. The cash is the problem.
They don't even know if there is, like, a fence for like aftermarket stolen cannabis. You know, like, hey, I got my guy. Let's go to Kansas City.
Yeah, it makes no sense. It'd be like, I'm not going to go in the liquor store to steal all your liquor. Like I'm, oh, give me all your.
How much you got in the till? I got $10,000. All right, I'll take the scotch.
Yeah. Give me all your Seagrams and Crown. I don't want anything else. Yeah. Like, nobody does that.
That's definitely not happening. But yeah, I mean, it only makes sense for everyone. I mean, we've talked about safe banking a bunch in the past, but I think it's becoming a much more of a safety issue. And it's not just about banking regulations, but it is about the fact that people are realizing right now that one of the things that safe solves is, you know, taking thousands and thousands of dispensaries across the country and making them significantly safer to the general public as a result of taking cash out of the transaction, or at least largely taking cash out of the transaction. It's not to say you can't pay by cash, but, you know, if given the opportunity, I can't think of the last time I've carried cash. Like, you know, I have it for like odds and ends, but other than that, I'm in the digital world completely.
And it's employees, it's customers, and it's the people just near the area. I mean, why do you want to put those people in jeopardy? Why would we do that? It doesn't make any sense. So we need to, hopefully this is another step in the right direction of the Montana senator coming out on this, on realizing it's just bad policy not to fix this one issue. You don't have to be you don't have to be pro cannabis. Just make it safe for everybody.
Agreed. Agreed. So getting back to June 12th, 1980, it's been a choppy episode today. We sort of toggle back and forth. There's no clean segues the way there were last week when we were able to, you know, use song quotes to jump between songs. But, you know, today it's much more, you know, thematic as we're kind of going back and forth with topics. But I love early June. Early June, if, you know, you're a college student, was when, you know, college had just ended. If you're a music fan, that meant that tour was starting, no matter what band you wanted to see, whether it was, you know, Panic or Fish or the Grateful Dead or whoever else. You know, if you're going to go to music festivals, you know, Bonnaroo was usually the first week in June. A lot of the other bigger ones were, you know, the first week of June. Is, you know, you were kicking off the music season. That was like right now, like a lot, some of the bands I just mentioned are in full swing with their tours right now. Music is back. Everyone's outdoors. Everyone's, you know, barefoot, you know, wearing shorts, t-shirts. It's just a great time of year. And, you know, for me, I'm spoiled. Southern California is like this all the time. But even down here, it's been, you know, I'm out playing tennis in the evenings and doing stuff and, you know, finding outdoor activities to do. There's more barbecues, more, you know, eating outside. So it's the best time of year, right? And for the Grateful Dead, that was always, you know, like June was definitely a peak of like kicking off their summer tour. But this year in particular, you know, as I said, May 18th, 1980, St. Helens blows its top. They'd obviously long ago, you know, announced the show. So it wasn't just, you know, pick it up and cancel, say, okay, we're not going to play Portland. At that point, I don't think people were expecting that they were going to continue to have eruptions, but it did happen. And some of the quotes, you know, some of the descriptions of this night, I think are worth, you know, reading through because it's pretty cool. So if you look at the Grateful Dead of the Day website, they featured the show as their dead show of the day. And their quote on it was, Eruptions occurred occasionally in the months afterwards, including on June 12th. On that day, a plume of ash billowed 2.5 miles above the volcano at 7.05 p.m., about the time the dead first went on. At 9.09 p.m., smack in the middle of the fire of the mountain, a much stronger explosion followed, sending 10 miles of ash straight up. The entire city of Portland was coated by the plume, including the lot of the Coliseum. So think about this for a second, Dan. You're at a show, the dead kick into fire on the mountain, and boom, like a mountain that you can see in the distance erupts and sends ash 10 miles into the air. And you're high out of your mind watching the show going, holy shit, what just happened?
Yeah. Did that really happen? That's like I'm saying, yeah. You're sitting there going, wow, really?
So,
especially that I can't help but be a skeptic, but it's happened so many times, or at least you've told me stories so many times where the song is playing when this happens. Like that is just, it's just such a coincidence, such a great coincidence that happens.
It's a coincidence when it happens once, you know, it's a miracle when it happens twice, but when, you know, for the dead, it seemed to happen with somewhat, you know, frequency, right? You know, it wasn't, you could always count on it, but you know, more weird stuff happened than not. But this one is one for the books that, you know, 9.09 p.m. right in the middle of fire on the mountain when this thing happens. It's crazy. And one of the things that, you know, I loved is Bill Walton's description afterwards. And so let me read a quick bit of this, which was posted on Jambase. And it was an interview with Bill and said, "We were on tour with the Grateful Dead in Oregon. They were playing the show and they start playing Fire on the Mountain. The volcano next door, Mount St. Helens, blows up. When the show was over, a bunch of us raced to the airport and boarded a plane. We told the people at the airport we were scientists studying atmospheric conditions and the effect of smoke and volcanic explosions on the human spirit. So the pilot was terrified, but we convinced him to fly right into the smoking crater with lava and fire everywhere. He wanted to go home, but we were still on a scientific mission. We kept getting closer and closer. As we were flying around the inside of the erupting volcano, the military jets scrambled from the local base and came up there to get us out. It was a real dogfight, but we had the spirit of Cortez on our side. And eventually left, and we landed at the airport, and the pilot was most relieved as we quickly fled and went back to the rest of the tour."
That is...
I mean, only Walton, right?
That's, I mean, guy, I got to give him a lot of credit, because that's scary stuff. I mean, it's cool afterwards, but at the time, I would be nervous going over the... Unless he was...
It's not scary. It's batshit crazy. I mean, if what he's saying is true, and there's a plume of smoke that's up in the air. I mean, as I said, like, cars were breaking down the highway because they couldn't get from Portland to Seattle. I can't imagine taking a small plane and flying it over the caldera at, you know, a couple hours later when the thing is still smoking, there's still lava down below. If what he's saying is right and not, you know, some sort of, you know, memory that's been embellished over time... That's one of the most absurd things I've ever heard in my life that Walton did.
Especially since what you said earlier is that it blew once, and then at 9:03 or 9:00, it blew again. So there's no telling. There's no way to know if it's going to blow again when you're flying a plane over it.
Okay, so I look at this a different way. You know, I kind of think back to Robin Williams in The World According to Garp, when, you know, the plane flies into the building, he looks at the real estate and he's like, "I'll take it." And his wife looks at him, you know, "Are you joking?" He's like, "Look, the chances of that happening again are astronomical, right?" So I look at it that way. Or I look at, you know, like, I remember, you know, being in Europe one time and I was about to drop into a line and the cornice right above the line dropped and just avalanched the entire face. And I looked at my buddy and I was like, "All right, let's go." And we dropped in right after. And everyone's like, no, avalanche. We're like, "The avalanche already went, you know, like, you know, what are we worried about? The whole face slid, you know,
there's not going to happen.
There's
twice,
no other instability in the snowpack." Yeah. So, you know, there's times like if you watch the big one go, you're probably going, "All right, well, you know, that's exploded again. We're probably okay to go in there." But even still, it's not necessarily the safest thing to do.
I don't even know if I want to be in that state, let alone over top of the volcano. I mean, but
have you ever been on a smoking caldera? Have you ever like looked into like where the like the lava and stuff is actually like in front of you?
Yeah, in Hawaii. Yeah. But and not, I mean, I was behind a fence and it was, you know,
and that's not Hawaii. Those aren't like cataclysmic explosions either. Those aren't like shield volcanoes where like the whole top blows. Those are, you know, just magma sort of steadily pouring out. So a bit safer. I've done it down in Guatemala where, you know, they're a bit more volatile. You know, there's big cone volcanoes. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, it's a little nerve wracking to look down there and go like, "Whoa, that's happening right in front of me."
So. Yeah, I'd say. I'd say. Wow. Wow. That's, well, so he was It was right in the middle of Fire in the Mountain.
Yeah. So the story goes.
Should we play a little Fire in the Mountain?
Let's do it. Let's hear it from that night. The wind down right at the end after the jam, after the third verse. But I gotta think, if you're the band and you're on stage and Mount St. Helens blows its top while you're playing Fire, it's probably got to make you play a little bit differently that night, and just thinking to yourselves, like, there's no way that just happened.
That's crazy. I'll tell you, I'm going to take a sidebar here, because I actually know exactly what I was doing probably at
909, I think, is when the
I think I know exactly what I was doing at 909. It was my 17th birthday, and I was praying to the porcelain god with my buddies. Southern Comfort is what put me through, and never ever have been able to drink Southern Comfort since then. But I remember clearly where I was when I mean, it might not have been 1209. East Coast time. It may not have been 1209. It may have been 109, but at some point I was in bad shape.
An eruption of your own.
I was having an eruption of my own. Yeah, I know that for sure.
I made it 1 year longer with Southern Comfort than you did, and I haven't touched it since I was 18. So I know that feeling. And it wasn't even that night. It's the next day when your whole pores are dripping Southern Comfort and you're like, that's it. I can't even look at a bottle without getting sick.
I can't smell it. If somebody brings it, oh god, it's so bad. I'm like, I can't even smell that. But I was scarred on that night, June 12th, 1980, 17th birthday. So
that's too funny.
Anyhow.
Well, so hey, before we go, we've got some good guests that we know are coming on the show soon. We don't have dates set for them, but over the next couple of weeks, we're gonna have some really fun good guests coming to join us. Larry should be back from the Grand Canyon, so excited to hear from him on how his trip down to the bottom of the canyon was. Hopefully he's dealing with the vortexes okay in Sedona and all the rest of that interesting hippie stuff that's happening out there. We started the show today with little Chuck Berry with Promised Land. And, you know, I can tell people that my first show in California, they played a Promised Land. It's my first time flying to a show. So, you know, I definitely identified with the final verse of, you know, cut your engines and cool your wings and let me make it to the telephone, of letting people know that I'd made it safe to California to see some dead shows. And I think that was Oakland of December 1990, the New Year's run, where I started off hitchhiking across the Utah desert and no one would pick us up. And I made it as far as the Salt Lake City airport and said, okay, that's good enough for me. And I went over and bought a ticket and went instead. So I think I made it 18 miles from my dorm to when I gave up about 8 hours later. But, it's rare you get two Chuck Berry tunes in the same night. So Portland did it. Portland, June 12th, 1980, they finished it off with a Johnny B. Goode after opening up with Promised Land, or second song, Promised Land. So as we head out this evening, just want to say, you know, thank you, Dan, for joining us and being a surrogate host with me today. We'll have Larry back next week. But until then, I'm going to send you off with a little Johnny B. Goode, and in the famous words of my co-host and sage and leader of the show, enjoy your canvas responsibly. Thank you.